Welcome to another session of Just Me. Today we're joined by Stephen Wheatley, who's going to tell us all about himself and what he's up to. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
So who are you? Please tell us.
Okay. Well, in no particular order of importance, you know my name, I'm Stephen. I'm 65 years old and I'm a business development specialist in the tech sector, currently running as CEO a business which looks after your hearing, safeguards your hearing if you're a headphone user, as I am at this moment. We're in the process of delivering that product into the market.
But your career is quite amazing, really. How did you get into the hearing business?
People write business books and tell you how they sat down when they were 21 and wrote out how they were going to become whatever it is they have become. I would like to suggest that might be post-race rationalization, because a lot of things that happen to you in life are serendipitous. They happen because you have done something, you've put yourself in a position, you've met somebody, you've networked, whatever it might be, and you've come across an opportunity of interest working with people who you'd like to work with, and you take that opportunity. So I started working as a management trainee for Sainsbury's in the 1970s, did 4 years there. Then I moved into sales, but selling into retail environments because I had been on the other side of that when I worked at Sainsbury's. The salespeople used to sell to me, and found that I was reasonably good at selling. And I've always been quite interested in technology. So I moved from selling fish fingers into cosmetics, into electronics, and then moved into electronic security. I then moved into vehicle electronic security. I've then been involved in a business of a consumer finance business, a automotive electronics business, and now I'm in another electronics business, which supplies software for wireless headphones.
So I love the fact that you started off in I just was smiling as you said, so from fish fingers to kind of cosmetics and then to electronics and whatever. And it's really funny, isn't it? Because the word career, actually, you know, if you said to somebody, you know, you're careering off course, actually, it's quite apt, isn't it? Because as you say, there's no straight line to any of this stuff.
No. And what happened is when I have to say, cosmetics did have its compensations when you're in your early 20s, because you get to meet lots of the opposite sex, if that's your thing. And at the time, it was mine. But I applied for a completely different job. I didn't get it. I didn't even get shortlisted. But the people who were the agency said, you haven't got that one, but would you like to look at this one? And this one was a electronic security business. And I said, yes, I'd like to look at it. I went on holiday with my girlfriend, came back to find a letter. These are in the days before emails and text messages and things. I found a letter on the mat saying, would you like to come for an interview, that was about a week old. So the interview took place while I was on holiday. And obviously I didn't show up and I didn't respond. But I thought, well, two things. One, I thought I ought to apologize to the people who'd asked me to go to the interview. And secondly, I'd ask them whether there was still a chance. So I phoned the general manager of the company who had asked me to go to interview. The interview was in London. I was living in the Midlands at the time. And they said, we haven't filled the post. If you'd like to come for the interview, that would be fine. And I drove down from the Midlands to London, went into the interview, expecting to be there for about an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. And I emerged 3 hours later with a job.
Whoa, so cool.
So I gained a job and nearly lost a girlfriend because she'd had to sit in the car in an industrial estate in North London waiting for me. Anyway, so yeah, so serendipity does play a big part in, if you like, if it's a career. I'm not sure it is a career. There are some people whose careers are linear. Mine certainly hasn't been.
I can't think of many people whose have been, really. So in terms of, what have you learnt along the way?
I think that's a very good question. a lot of what I've learned along the way probably only applies to me. Being self-aware, well, it does, because it's things that happened to me in that moment, in that certain situation. I took a decision, rightly or wrongly, to do something, and I'm now living with the consequences of that, good or bad. The things I've learned are, you'll always miss the shots you don't take. So if you think the ball is in the position where you might be able to get it in the goal, I mean, let's use a football analogy, with apologies to those who don't like football. But if you think that you have a chance of getting the ball in the net, it's probably a good thing to have a go. What you can guarantee is, if you don't kick it, you're never going to get it in the net. So take the opportunities. If you see an opportunity, explore it to a point where you either think this is good or you feel uncomfortable and you don't want to do it. And if you feel uncomfortable, even if it's a gut thing, don't do it, because it's sometimes an interrelationship thing. I don't know about you, but I have quite a good intuition. I can see people. I've been interviewed for jobs and thought, oh, that's a fantastic job. And I just wasn't quite sure about the people I was going to work with. And I didn't do it.
Funny, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, there's research, isn't there, coming out now about, you know, how that you do have a kind of brain in your gut, and those feelings that we get, that uncomfortable feeling, you know.
Well, if you think about, you have a number of different contributing systems in your body that they were originally designed. So forget about all the fact that we're sophisticated people and you've phoned me from 300 miles away and we're now doing a podcast. We're now sitting in a cave somewhere, and we are operating. We probably can't have a conversation in as we would know it. You can't intellectualize that process. So you have processes in your body. So a common one would be a fight and flight response. So there have been experiments done where you put somebody in front of a glass window. Okay, they know they're in front of a glass window, and you tell them to stare through the window. There's nothing the other side of it. And very suddenly you introduce a snake on the other side of the window. Now, there isn't sufficient time in the wild to think about protecting yourself from the snake. So what you do is you have an automatic reaction, which is to close your eyes and flee. And you will have, if you took a blood test, you'd have increases in some adrenaline-based products, which will give you the ability to run really quickly. We have those sensors about other people. Is this person complementary to me, as in, can I exist in the same space as this person? Or do I feel uncomfortable in their presence? And I don't know whether it's a gender issue. It may be risky to say, but I know lots of women who say there's something creepy about that person.
Yeah, funny, isn't it?
But it is their unconscious reaction to that person. And you shouldn't necessarily ignore it just because we're clever, we can talk ourselves out of it.
Well, I think this with animals. I'm obviously a big animal lover, and I have a dog. And it's interesting. I mean, my dog Bilbo, he knows people, and it's really funny, the people that he will not go up to, but the people that he absolutely adores. It's really funny. And it's so funny when I kind of look at them and I think about them. I think, well, actually, he's right. You know, I'm a little bit distanced with that particular person. And obviously, you know, he picks up on that as well. So next question. So what and who has helped you along the way? So where have you been able to dig deep with yourself, with somebody? You know, what has helped and who has helped you?
Well, I'm very lucky that I'm married, and I'm still married to the same woman. So early 1980s, I made a decision to marry Barbara, and we're still married. And so one of the reasons we married is we were very, very good friends. And you see, you know, we've got three kids as well, so there's nothing wrong in that department in terms of love and all that sort of stuff. But underneath, I actually respect her values, and she mine. So we're buddies. And, you know, we've now been together, whatever that is, 37. Yeah, so 37 and a half years or whatever it is.
Wow.
And it hasn't, you know, don't get me wrong, it's not always been plain sailing. But having a mate, and I mean that in the sort of biological sense, having a mate who you trust and can rely on when things are, you know, she's been there when the things have been great, and she's been there when the things haven't been great. And you know, she's an absolute brick. The kids, I've got three kids, I've got three grandkids, all of that is really really motivating and helpful. Outside that, in a sort of business sense, I mentioned earlier on, I went for an hour and a half interview in the early 1970s. The chap that interviewed me became a very strong mentor. He saw something in me that I didn't know I had. And he gave me an opportunity. I took over a role in Birmingham. They gave me an office that was about 10 by 12, a telephone, a desk, and a yellow pages, and said, get on with it. And no training. And so one did what one might do and sort of read a bit about sales, bought loads of the latest books. There were no such things as podcasts then. He put me in a very difficult position, but he trusted me. So it was quite interesting. I've just come across something recently. Have you come across the inner game theory?
Sort of.
It's an American tennis coach originally. It's called the inner game tennis. But the idea is that you create conditions and people have to subdue their own fears to release their own potential. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's similar to John Wooden stuff, yes. A great basketball coach, and he did the whole pyramid of success, but very much that inner game.
But it's interesting. Let me give you an example. I'm quite a keen cyclist, and if you go to the Alps, you watch these cyclists in the Tour de France, and they glibly say this climb is 23 kilometres. Well, I think that's about 17 miles, and it's all uphill.
Right.
And if you get you know, a mile or two into that, and it's 5 or 6%, so it's a fair old stretch, and some of it goes up to 10 or 12. If you tell yourself you can't do it, you won't.
Yeah.
Because you just, it's a lot of it is about convincing yourself that you have that strength, that ability. And I often bring to mind a quote from somebody who I particularly admire. He was a wonderful footballer, called George Best, which is that pain is temporary. He said, glory lasts forever. I hope I'm not that arrogant. I think pride lasts forever. So I'm very proud of some of the things I've done in the Alps. And, you know, I'm just proud that I did it. I don't really need to tell anybody about it. The thing is, if you can talk yourself out of it, and there is, you know, it's best you don't, you know, give it a go, have a shot, do your best, and, you know, really, really commit to things.
So I love that, because that is that thing. It's the inner critic, isn't it? The self-doubt, you know, and there's Ben Fogle. I went to see him, you know, years ago, and I remember him talking about, because he's obviously gone up, you know, Everest and done amazing, amazing things. And he said that when he was at school, he knew that he wasn't particularly great at anything, you know, sports wise or whatever. But he said that I made a decision to be a completer and not a competer. And I really like that, because I think for a lot of people, it's like, as you say, with the Alps, and I do loads of cycling as well, I'm not going to come first, but I'll get it done.
You've just said something, and I don't have a great deal of hair, but the hair that I have just stood up when you said I'm a completer, not a competitor. I'm with you. You know, a slow and steady often wins the race. I did
the hare and the tortoise.
I did a climb with some buddies. I'm in a slightly nuts. So I'm in two cycling clubs. I'm in a cycling club called CC London, which is a cycling club with a drinking problem, and then I'm in a cycling club called Club Grappa. Club Grappa is a drinking club with a cycling problem. And it is they're a brilliant group of people and lots of fun. And we went off and did some climbing in the Alps. And the professionals do this particular climb in about 45 minutes. It's very tough. I did it in about an hour and 45 minutes.
Wow.
And I got to the top and most of my colleagues were there to greet me, sat outside the bar. And I said, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm far too old for this. And they said, how many other 60-year-old blokes passed you on the way up?
Yeah.
and that's all they needed to say. You know, they didn't, you know, and so that's a lovely expression, that completer, not a competer. I spent quite a bit of time with people who were in the military. And one of them in particular was one of the training sergeant majors at the Marines training establishment in Limpston. And he was talking to me. He loves the stuff I do. And he was saying to me, how do you do it? And we got sort of into it. And I said, well, what do you do with the Marines? He said, look, what you have to understand is when most people's bodies are screaming to stop, how much of your reserve have you got left, physical reserve? And the answer is approximately a half. So what they do is they train the Marines to use up the half they think they've got, and then they push them to mine into the half they didn't know they had.
Wow.
Whether it's physical, mental, or whatever, whenever you think you're done, what that is your body is trying to stop you from harming it and to give you reserve to allow you to deal with another attack. So go back to you and I back in the cave. We suddenly find there's a bear in the corner of this cave and we get out of there and we run as fast as we can until we you know, and then after, say, 2 or 3 miles, we think we're done. That's our body saying stop now and preserve some of your energy in case you get attacked by another bear.
What I love, Stephen, is that when you look at, you know, the challenges that people, you know, take on mentally, physically, and a combination of both, of what people can actually achieve, and very much like you, you know, the talks that I give, it's you know, you have no idea what you are truly capable of. And I think that's the great thing, isn't it? That when you do an amazing bike ride, or even if it's a couch to 5K or a couch to 1K, whatever that is, you know, it's the mind that says if you think you can do it, then you will. And, you know, even if you try and do a 5K or you do a couch to 5K and you don't fail, it doesn't mean that you're going to fail forever. It just means that you didn't do that right now. And I think, I mean, that's actually part of my next question, really. So what advice would you have given your younger self, or even to kind of young people? Because young people at the moment, it's terribly hard for them, isn't it, in terms of COVID and everything else?
I think that's right. I've got young grandchildren, sort of 4 or 5. So they're at the moment, they're a delight, and they're not really that impacted. I am concerned about what they will believe and think when they're 15 or 16. And my children, their parents are in their mid-30s, so they are now fully independent. I think the environment that our children are growing up in, and I would probably, I don't want to pigeonhole them because it'll be different for everybody, but I think they're subjected to a lot of what masquerades as entertainment but could be terribly demoralizing. I think the idea of talent shows, whatever sort of talent show it happens to be, undermines the idea that you might have to do quite a lot of work. So what you see on a Saturday night, I don't tend to watch these things, though sometimes I do, you might see a child on The Voice, you know, a 14-year-old girl suddenly get everybody turning, and you know, suddenly she's going to have 150,000 followers on Instagram, and you know, she's on her way because she's been on The Voice. What I think we underestimate, or perhaps children will underestimate, is how much work she put in to be able to do what it is she does, and also how many people were cast aside on the way to her getting that opportunity, not by her, but by the people that make the television program. So you see samples of the auditions, but you only see the ones that are either very good or terrible or funny, because that's television, isn't it? you probably, what you've got to realize is these are bluebird moments. You know, they are, it's fantastic for the people involved if they can cope with that, and that's what they want. It's fantastic for them. But for every one of them that ends up on that stage, I don't know how many hundred others there are that have been discarded and their dreams smashed. And also, they've tried very hard. I think, what would I say to younger self? I think you're probably more capable than you believe you are.
Brilliant.
I would strongly recommend that you get a coach.
That's nice.
Historically, not quite all the way back to the cave, but when we lived in social groups in villages and things of that nature, you would be adopted by somebody in the village. I was adopted when I was 14 by two blokes who owned a bike shop.
Brilliant.
So that's how I got into bikes. And they couldn't pay me because I was too young. Mr. and Mr. Stokes, Mr. Stokes the elder was probably in his 70s, and Mr. Stokes the younger was probably in his 40s. They couldn't pay me, and I'd go to the shop. I'd do whatever they told me to do, and they'd pay me every night with a brown paper bag full of some components for my bike.
Oh, lovely!
And I had no say in what it was. And very cleverly, they never gave me a complete system for my bike. And do you know why?
I love that.
Because I had to keep going back.
Oh.
So they mentored me when I was 14. And then I worked in a garage when I was, at school. And the guy that ran that garage, he was a bit of a sort of a vuncular sort of chap. But because we don't necessarily have these experiences anymore, or when you're 16, I didn't do an apprenticeship, but, when you're 16, you did an apprenticeship and you would end up, my youngest son did an apprenticeship in Derby with Rolls-Royce, and he had what he calls his work dad. And Tony's his work dad. And he would talk to Tony about stuff that he probably wouldn't talk to me about. And Tony got him through all of his exams. So find people that you admire and you get on with and you trust. And, hopefully they will coach you or mentor you. Yeah, I think I'd probably have done that. There's times in my life when I definitely should have had a coach and didn't. And the outcome wasn't anywhere near as good as it could have been.
And it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I recently have done a professional coaching or executive coaching course, and it's amazing that of how powerful coaching is, but how little involvement the coach sometimes needs in order to help the person, the coachee, find new direction or new purpose or whatever. And I think that's the thing that amazes me. It's just creating that space, isn't it? Just to talk, just to have some, as you say, a work dad or whatever that is. It's really, it's such an amazing opportunity to take.
There's a couple of things that, one of my mentees, I believe, and we have an expression that, first of all, there's no daft thing. You can't say anything daft. Because it doesn't matter, just say it. And a lot of ideas don't survive contact with air. So you've got something going round in your head. And when you say it to somebody who you trust, who has your best interests at heart, the reaction you probably want is, that's interesting. Why do you think that? Or why is that of interest to you? And then as you try to explain it to your coach or your mentor, often the idea changes into something that is practical, or it disappears completely. I think, again, it's part of that's how we're programmed. I don't think there's any deep psychology about it particularly. I think it just works. So we have this expression, many ideas don't exist after contact with air.
Brilliant, love that.
But there has to be a trusted space. You have to know that the person isn't going to ridicule you. You have to trust them. You have to know that they're not predatory, that they're not going to use what you say in a way against you. You have to have that trust. And if you do, it's incredible. And it's so I've been on both sides of this as a mentee myself and as a coach. The coach position is such a privileged position.
Yeah, it is.
And hugely rewarding.
And as you say, hugely beneficial from both sides. So, last question. So, what legacy would you like to leave behind?
Well, I think I'd like to divide that answer into two answers. One is a personal one. I'm not a religious person. And so my legacy, if you like, is my family, my children and my grandchildren and those. And I would hope that they will prosper and be healthy and you know, be better. We'll leave the world a better place than where they found it. Because that's, you know, not being religious, I can't hope for more than that, I suppose. I hope you don't think I'm being greedy. And then from a personal point of view, I'd really like to make sure that the work we've been doing over the last 10 years to safeguard the hearing of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people who use headphones is actually deployed successfully.
Wow.
As somebody who suffers myself from hearing loss caused by motorcycles, Led Zeppelin and shooting, which somebody did say is not a bad way to lose it. I think people need to be conscious of the risk. And, okay, I don't want to spoil anybody's fun, but if you know the risk you're taking, then you can manage it. At the moment, people don't know the risk, and we have techniques and technologies in HearAngel that will hopefully help them do that. So
that's fantastic. I love that.
There's some other things. I've got some other things to do. I've got some challenges I want to do, but, you know.
More cycling.
Yes, I want to do cross Europe, so ride from the west coast of Ireland to the Black Sea.
Wow.
But I want to do it in stages. So people have said they would like to come and join me for a week or a few days, and so I'll have an itinerary and they can come and I'll say, you know, I'll meet you at Amsterdam Central Railway Station on this day, and then, you know, and off you go. I'd love to do that. I think Europe's, you know, it sounds like it's one place, and of course it isn't. It's very, very different. So I think that'd be a great adventure. So
that'd be fantastic. Yeah, that'd be really nice.
With friends, yeah. In civilization. You're very welcome if you'd like to come.
Sounds like I would like to do that, actually. Yeah, let me know when you're doing it. Stephen, thank you so much for your time. Amazing. Really, really loved the...
I hope you've got what you want, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed themselves.
Yeah, thank you very much. And by the way, listeners, we will be putting links into the work that Stephen does do with headphones and safeguarding on hearing and things. So that will be in the notes. But Stephen, lovely to meet you again, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.